many people are still, I would say, stuck in thinking about all this renewable stuff and this electric stuff as something that's worse than what we had, but we have to do it anyway. And I think that's really the wrong way to look at it. I often say maybe the Industrial Revolution, maybe fossil fuels was our caterpillar stage, and now we're coming to the butterfly stage.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is the Climate 21 podcast, the number one podcast showcasing best practices in climate emissions reductions. And I'm your host, Global Vice President for SAP, Tom Raftery. Climate 21 is the name of an initiative by SAP to allow our customers calculate, report, and reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. In this Climate 21 podcast, I will showcase best practices and thought leadership by SAP, by our customers, by our partners, and by our competitors, if they're game, in climate emissions reductions. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast in your podcast app of choice to be sure you don't miss any episodes. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Climate 21 podcast. My name is Tom Raftery with SAP, and with me on the show today, I have my special guest, Auka. Auka, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, very quickly about myself. I'm known on Twitter as a sort of a debunker in chief, some say, of electric vehicle scare stories. I used to be in internet. I found a lot of people who are know a lot about internet, a lot about computers, sort of get this whole transition we're going through in energy mobility very quickly. And I like to think I was one of them. So 13 years ago, I took a sabbatical, basically to figure out how I would spend the rest of my life, my career, after doing all kind of computer things. And a little bit like Shai Agassi, well known, I think, for people who know SAP, I thought renewable energy is a worthwhile goal to focus on. So I wrote a couple of books on electric vehicles, and the pinnacle of my sort of achievement so far is that last year I wrote a proposal for 35 scientists to basically make better models to guide us towards a future with low carbon mobility and low carbon energy. And it got granted, so now I'm leading those 35 scientists for the coming 5 years. And on a personal note, when you study this so much, it also becomes a personal hobby, at least in my case. So I'm presenting this from my energy positive house, wooden energy positive house with the electric car charging from it. And I find that living low carbon lifestyles is basically a luxury in our modern world.
Lovely, lovely. And just for people who didn't catch it at the start, your name is Auka what, and where are you working?
Good point. Okay, I'm Auka Hoekstra. That's how you pronounce it in Dutch. And I work at the Technical University of Eindhoven, Technical University like MIT, I would say, but now in Eindhoven. Eindhoven is actually the smartest kilometer in the world. It was voted like that 3 years ago or something, because there's a lot of companies also around there. So it's a very nice place to come up with these improvements we're going to discuss in the podcast.
Great. The decarbonization of the grid is obviously something that is hugely important in terms of, I mean, this is the Climate 21 podcast, and we're talking about ways to reduce emissions. There's been a massive shift in the last probably decade, I would say, in how energy is being generated. And a lot of that is down to the rise in renewables, which is down to, for exactly, a change, it's down to economics, which I think is fantastic, because as far as I can see, that's financially sustainable. The fact that it's down to economics, it means it's going to stay that way, which means, you know, the world has changed. What are your observations on this space, Auka?
Yeah, that was actually the reason during my sabbatical that I decided to make the change. I was always afraid that this was always going to be a pipe dream that we had to do, but wouldn't, because it would mean giving up stuff in the short term, and we would not be morally strong enough to do that. But then I found out that just as internet technology, like Moore's law, you know, like is very predictable in a way, you could predict actually how batteries, electric vehicles, wind and solar became cheaper. And once I started to sort of charting that out and also finding a lot of scientists who were actually already doing that, that was the moment I realized, hey, this is actually going to work. We just have to make it work in time. So I'm just speeding up the process. It will undoubtedly work. It's simply a better technology, a renewable energy that now comes available. But yeah, we have to hurry up.
Okay. And it's not just the renewables that I mentioned as well. There's also the shift to storage, because as we all know, renewables are variable generators, and electric grids don't like variability. So the shift to storage means that we can take in certain amounts of excess energy, put it in lithium-ion batteries, for example, which are right now the storage mechanism du jour. They're the kind of one that are kind of the sexy one and affordable one right now. In the future, there might be other forms of storage, but right now they're the ones that are starting to win on the price basis, at least. Mm-hmm. Where do you see this going? I mean, it's right now we're seeing just the batteries starting to become, to make economic sense, with some utilities starting to deploy them at scale.
So what I see, so basically this is the very interesting dynamic here is that more and more and more energy is going to be electrified. Electrify everything. Everything is not just a slogan. It's really happening. Mm-hmm. So that makes the electricity grid more important. More important. The cheapest and societally best way of doing that at the moment is with wind and solar. Mm-hmm. Full disclosure, I'm not against nuclear, but I think it's simply expensive and slow at the moment. So not so much scary as expensive and slow. So wind and solar. But yeah, if you run a whole world on wind and solar, and of course the sun and it goes down a lot of the time, and the wind doesn't blow all the time, how do you do that? That's one of the main topics of the models I told you about a couple of minutes ago. This NEOM project that I'm this large project that I'm heading. We want to make sure that we understand how demand and supply can fluctuate in time, and what kind of storage interventions you need to make sure that the grid stays balanced all the time. And actually, there's two kinds of storage that are really important. If you make it simple, if you break it down into simple parts, one is the, let's say, daily storage. Mm-hmm. So these are fluctuations that basically happen once or even more times a day. And for that, batteries are actually really good, because batteries have a really efficient round time. So if you put energy in them and take it out again, you could end up with 90% of the energy. So you lose very little in the round trip. By the way, hydro storage is also a good example of that. So Norway, for example, can simply not use hydro for a couple of hours and then open floodgates literally again. And that way they can manage it. But most countries don't have that much hydro.
Yep.
But long term, that's so let's say seasonal fluctuations, there's actually a much harder problem. So it's not a problem, by the way, when you live very close to the equator, where you have solar every day basically, and where summer and winter are both seasons where a lot of energy is being offered to you. But for example, if you live in the Netherlands, which I'm told only 1% of the world lives further away from the equator than we in the Netherlands.
Wow.
And of course some people in Poland, etc. But actually through the warm Gulf Stream, Europe is a bit warmer up there than most other parts of the world. So yeah, we are a special problem, you could say, people who live that far away from the equator, also Germany, of course. And then you need some chemical storage. And I'm very happy with how fast hydrogen is coming and e-fuels are coming and all that sort of. Yeah, there's a lot of approaches basically to turn electricity into some sort of chemical storage, which is super inefficient. That's the sad part about it, but it's very easy to store.
Okay.
So if you need it only once a year, it's not that bad if you just throw away part of the surplus in the summer, mostly, and have most of that energy, or at least a large part of the energy, available in the winter, very simply put. So I see salt caverns, for example, using hydrogen as one of the ways to address seasonal storage. And most importantly, by the way, flexibility. If we use, for example, the moment we charge cars, or even if we use the battery of cars as a way to give back energy to the grid, and if we make a lot of our appliances, like heat pumps, etc., react to the best moment, cheapest moment, also for the people using it, where there's the most green energy. Mm-hmm. That's basically. There's basically free storage, you could say. That is free time shifting. That is an almost, basically you only need some computer smarts, and then you have a lot less problems. So flexibility, which is not part of our current system, is also basically in a very important form of storage. And then there's daily fluctuations with batteries and seasonal fluctuations with hydrogen. So these three forms of storage should all be utilized.
Yeah, interesting. I've been talking for a long time about demand side management and using things like, freezers, for example, either industrial or in the home. If they were smart, you don't care whether your freezer, your home freezer, is at -2 or -10. You know, so freeze it to -10 and let it drift to -2. And, you know, that right there is a form of energy storage. Or hot water, if you use electric water heaters, again, you don't care if the water in your heater is at, you know, +80 or +60. And again, that kind of the difference between the two can be managed by an electric immersion, which is listening to demand signals or pricing signals on a grid, where the pricing signals are linked to the penetration of renewables generating at any point in time.
Exactly. I have a nice anecdote about it too, by the way. Our CEO, that is also in my consulting company, Peter Molengraaf, once talked to SATA, a steel producing company. It was called Hoogoven in the day. And he said, do you see any possibility to be more flexible? And for a long time, they told him no. And then all of a sudden, somebody came up with a simple example that they used to do when there was a big difference in tariff between the day and the night. Okay. They called it a little thermo. But it was basically a container that they filled with molten metal during the night. Okay. They have it on tap during the day, so they could use the cheap night electricity to fill a container full of molten metal. And the CEO said, do you know how much energy it takes to melt a full container or full of metal? And we thought it was more than, I would say, 20,000 households or something. So in industry, there's a lot of flexibility to be tapped also. And I'm now also wondering if, for example, ERP systems or something could do something with that too. See how they could maximize that flexibility without impacting, for example, a target like the throughput time or something of the whole process.
Interesting, yeah.
So there's lots of stuff to be found there. As you said, demand side management is super important.
Yeah, and you mentioned seasonal management as well, using hydrogen in, for example, I think you said salt caverns.
Yes.
That's an interesting one. What about other things like, I've come across things like liquid air storage and aqueous flow batteries. They're kind of a bit exotic at the moment. They're nowhere near at commercial grade, but the liquid air one sounds almost, you know, too good to be true, in that, you know, it's very simple. You're just taking air out of the atmosphere, compressing it and chilling it down to, you know, the point where it becomes liquefied, and then you can store it for long time, because it's just liquid air, and it's at probably -80 or something like that. I'm not sure exactly what the temperatures would be. And then you just release it out through a turbine and it generates electricity again. So it should, in theory, be highly efficient.
Actually, I don't know. That's interesting. I know that compressed air is interesting too, almost like hydro. Like you take a mine and you compress air into that, and basically that's the same
similar idea
way of
yeah.
working as hydro. But the problem there is that you need really, really, really large mines to have a lot of capacity. And of course, if you chill the air down, the volumetric density becomes much, much higher. Actually, I didn't study that. I will. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, no problem. And what about, I've seen as well proposals for changing hydrogen into ammonia for ease of transportation.
We see that a lot more. I think it has a very good shot. But basically, there's a growing awareness that, for example, producing hydrogen in places where there's lots of solar and where solar panels have both lots of room, lots of solar, and so the efficiency and the cost efficiency is high, cost low. But getting it from there to here we used to think of pipelines, but mm-hmm. maybe that's politically problematic. And once you have to ship it, because that's the next option then, I think ammonia, there's lots of stuff to be worked out there. There's lots of uncertainties about the cost of it. But I think ammonia indeed is a very good way to use it. By the way, you could make lots of e-fuels when you start with hydrogen. Sure. Also, if you combine it with CCS. So most people I know, for example, who are interested in airplanes, they are really looking at what kind of e-fuels would be most appropriate for us, because they think hydrogen planes that require a complete would be most efficient actually, but require a very large redesign of the plane. So that's sort of for them a long-term prospect. Mm-hmm. But I think, well, e-fuels, let's get on with that. So I think e-fuels is basically the most exciting development, and I see hydrogen then as an e-fuel too. But ammonia is like a next step that's easier to transport. Yeah. You could also make methane that way. That's one of the most exciting things happening in renewable energy right now, I think.
Yeah.
Research, it's very hard to predict where that is going.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No, I can totally get it. There are so many things going on. It's hard to keep track, and they're all at very early stage. So it's impossible, I'm sure, to figure out which one is going to be the winner.
Exactly. So cost and performance metrics like efficiency and volumetric density, very hard to guess at this moment, but it's almost impossible that nothing comes out of that, because there's so many pathways to turn electricity into chemical bonds that some of them will become, I think, pretty cheap probably in the long term.
Super.
And then we can produce our own oil. I mean, that's kind of cool. We only need very, very little of it, because we can manage, I would say, 95% of our economy won't need it anymore because it's so inefficient. Mm-hmm. But for the really hard parts, we can then produce it ourselves. How cool is that? Yeah.
No longer need to dig up those dinosaurs.
Right. Stop burning fossil. Dinosaur fuel, dinosaur blood, whatever. Yeah. By the way, to be quite honest, it's mostly trees, etc., right?
I know. And microorganisms.
But from the period when the dinosaurs were there, right? Yeah.
What about things like industrial processes? Because a huge amount of our CO2 footprint today is, we'll get onto transportation in a minute, but is in things like smelting iron, smelting aluminium, smelting bauxite into aluminium, and in making concrete. Can we use electricity for those? I mean, I've seen lots of proposals again around using hydrogen for those, because obviously today it's done primarily by using coke coal. So you're burning rocks to burn rocks, which makes no sense.
Yeah, every industry has its own pathway. So like e-fuels, but then and then even more complex, because there's so many different industries. Mm-hmm. But what I've seen so far, there's really no industry where there isn't a credible way to do it in a to do it low carbon.
Super.
So for example, cement is a harder one because there the product itself needs to be transformed in a way. But most other industries basically need loads of heat, for example. Yeah. And there's many ways to provide them with heat. We know how to do that. It's not even really sophisticated technology. It's just that embedding it in very complex industry processes requires a lot of thinking, a lot of investments, but also smartness. So once again, I could imagine that, for example, ERP programs could be used to sort of make that, make the more renewable process like building blocks where you can sort of experiment with how could my business process look if I did it in a renewable way. So it's a sort of a big process of finding out how we will do it. But that it's possible, I think, is almost non-negotiable. It's pretty clear. The problem only, to be honest, is that household, we all know our household very well. So everybody is always talking about how we can make our household more renewable. And so far, the industry sort of stays in the shadow a bit. So they're really behind the curve of what we're doing in the built environment, with what we're doing in households, I would say about 20 years or something. So
how much of that is down to regulation? Because I know the shipping industry, for example, has been really behind the curve.
Exactly.
Until the IMO came up with the regulations around emissions from shipping, which came into force at the start of this year. And it's the first time that there's been regulations around emissions from shipping. So we're starting to see movement there, but there's nothing similar that I'm aware of in concrete manufacture, in steel manufacture, in aluminium, any of those kind of things. Ah. Do we need regulations, global regulations, something like an IMO for concrete or for shipping? It's not shipping, it's concrete or aluminium and steel that, you know, can require these smelters to use lower carbon fuels.
Absolutely. By the way, I think for ships, to be quite honest, if I'm not mistaken, it's most for their particulate matters.
It's a slow process.
that's the easiest. It's like with cars. We already we had Dieselgate, but basically we're mostly our emissions in that respect are much lower now. So that proves, by the way, the regulation works.
Yes,
we absolutely need that. And actually, I think we don't even need sort of like worldwide regulation for that. If, for example, Europe would say, we think these things are really important. So, for example, you get subsidies or tariffs, depending on whether you follow these processes, then the whole European market would basically be there for the taking for those who followed the new rules, and would be very hard to get a large market share in if you didn't. So yes, I think that way you can create very large areas as launching customers that basically for the area, well, it drives the price up a little bit, but only to the extent that actually new technology is deployed, and you can also feel good about it, and it's not that big a deal. So if we wait for global agreements, it could take a long time, but maybe if a large area like China or America or Europe says, let's do this thing, we could be there, we could have a head start, we could hit the ground running or something.
Nice. Now, we've skirted around transportation, and I know it's a topic that both you and I share an interest in, and you do some great Twitter threads debunking articles. The most recent one was one that was in The Spectator a couple of days ago, although by the time this podcast publishes, it'll be a few weeks ago, so sorry about that. And there'll no doubt be other ones that you debunk between now and then. It makes for fantastic reading, just to sit there and read the threads that you put together debunking these. But it must be soul destroying to see them constantly coming up with articles saying that I don't know, saying that batteries cause problems, that we can never get to all electric because the grid can't handle it, which was the Spectator one, which, you know, and so on and so on and so on. How do you stay sane?
By realizing that apparently it's useful, and by having a lot of people tell me it's useful, I get a very good feeling from being useful, and this is apparently something I'm good at. So,
yep.
It's a good use of my talents. But yes, it is. I'm not saying soul destroying is a big word, but it's very. It's not always fun. I mean, I try to make it fun when I do it to make it a little bit playful. Mm-hmm. But no, I mean, and I've seen all those claims 100 times before, and I know very, very, very sure that they're not true. And then people start interacting with you on Twitter, and they start repeating the same things that you've just debunked because they didn't read your story. Yeah, that part is,
disheartening.
Is a job, I guess.
okay.
So what is nice about social media that you also get feedback from people who tell you, yeah, this is needed, keep up the good work, etc. And that is very nice. I mean, everybody loves to be, as I said, useful.
For people out who are listening who are not aware, what's happening in the transportation industry? I mean, we're seeing a huge shift. You and I are seeing a huge shift to electrification.
It's great. I started writing about it 13 years ago, and I thought it was so predictable, and it's been completely on track so far. So
great.
But basically, there's only two ways to move a vehicle, two motors that we have at our disposal. And this is true from the beginning of time. You have heat motors and, let's say, magnetic/electric motors. Mm-hmm. These are only two options. And of course, there's many different ways to make a heat motor, but basically it's all the same. You burn stuff, it gets bigger as it gets hotter, and that moves something. And there are all variants on that theme. And you have your magnetic motors, which look more alike than combustion engines, but basically also there, the thing is always the same. You create a magnetic field. That magnetic field wants to change the position of an axle, of a rotor, and that way, by manipulating that, you get forward motion. So these are our two options, and it was very clear from the beginning. I started writing about it, but even 100 years before that in terms of motors, the electric motor is clearly the winner. It is super efficient. It is much smaller. It doesn't need maintenance. It can go forever.
It's cleaner, very silent. It's quieter.
Yeah, exactly. So it's the clear winner. The problem was always the battery. Mm-hmm. And once you understand that, you start looking at that battery. And 100 years ago, I made a quick calculation that 100 years ago, you would need to take an elephant basically with you to, in terms of weight, but also size a little bit, to get the same range of a modern Tesla.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's not a really realistic proposition, I would say, apart from the fact that taking the elephant with you actually would necessitate taking another elephant with you. So, so let's forget about that for a moment. 20 years ago, it was a rhinoceros, still not a very, very realistic proposition, but things moved so fast. So by now, we're in between a pig and a good gorilla. So a gorilla is a little bit heavier than, I'm talking about a silverback gorilla. So it's like one or two people, right? So let's say we're three people. Actually, pigs and gorillas are big, actually. But anyway.
Okay. We're talking in the hundreds of kilos, not in the thousands.
Exactly. That's doable. And then what most people forget is that the electric drivetrain is actually much lighter. So people always look at the weight of the battery. Also, we'll get into e-trucks maybe in a minute. Yep. That's even more important there. And people forget basically to subtract the fact that the electric drivetrain is much lighter because you don't. Yeah, there's lots of stuff you don't need.
Yep.
I think by 2025, electric vehicles actually will be lighter. And then comes this: we can run it on solar and wind. We can do it. We can be super efficient. I mean, the way I always like to look at it from the start is how many square meters of surface on this beautiful blue dot do we need to move a car?
Okay.
And if you take biofuels, for example, which is basically oil is basically a biofuel we dig up, right? So yep. If you want to make it sustainable, it should be biofuel. Then you need about 100 or more square meters to propel yourself one kilometer, more or less.
Wow.
If you use solar panels, you only need 1 square meter to... I'm doing it wrong. Shit. I'm giving a wrong example here on live podcast.
It's not live, you're fine.
Point is, you need about 100 times more using biofuels, so it's super efficient. I mean, the solar panels on my roof are more than enough, one-third of them are more than enough to propel me in my electric vehicle year-round. So it's an extremely efficient way to use our surface. So once you understand how this whole system works, and once you understand how much lighter and cheaper batteries have become and what's in store in the coming decade, because if anything is developing super fast, even faster than those e-fuels we need, is batteries,
yeah.
Then you know it's really game over. This is just some incandescent light bulb manufacturers just not wanting to know that the LED is here. It's really game over.
It is. I mean, the numbers, according to Bloomberg, are that the price of batteries has dropped something like 87% since 2012, and the energy density of the batteries has tripled in the same time. So the batteries are getting way, way, way cheaper, and that's all down to the experience curve. So, and that's a beautiful virtuous circle as well, because you know, as they get cheaper, they become more affordable, more people can buy them. So you increase the amount that you make, which of course increases the learning curve, which drops the price, which makes them more attractive, which means more people can get them, which et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That just keeps on going.
Et cetera. Yeah, exactly, exactly. Once people understand the power of those learning curve, experience curves, and many people that are listening to our podcast are maybe aware of Moore's Law, which is basically another version of that, you could say. Once you realize that you shouldn't look at the present as if it's the present, but you should look at the present as a dot on this learning curve.
Yeah.
Then you understand that this beautiful thing happening here, and that we can at least find some hope there. Unfortunately, in climate space, there's also similar phenomena at work. So we could also have, they often call the tipping points then, if you have a learning curve and things would get out of hand quickly. But we also have a tipping point for electric vehicles, thankfully.
Yep.
And so that's indeed exactly what you said. That learning curve makes it really good news and only will speed up this adoption.
And we saw to your point about the tipping points, we saw in September of this year, September of 2020, for the first time in Europe, we saw the sales of electric vehicles overtake the sales of diesel. And of course, that's a trend. The sales for electric vehicles are going up. The sales of diesel are coming down. So that'll continue and the gap will widen and electric vehicles will become more the norm. They're already, if you look at Norway, they're already, you know, they're in excess of 50% of new vehicle sales, and that will happen across the rest of Europe as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. The Netherlands are also over 20% now, and it's gaining quickly.
And that's not going back.
It's absolutely not going back.
So that's all great about personal transportation, but really, if we look at emissions, again, which is really the focus of this podcast, or what I want it to be, the main emissions in transportation don't come from personal transportation. They come from buses, they come from delivery vehicles, they come from trucks, etc. like that. And you mentioned e-trucks earlier. What's happening in that space?
Yeah, to be quite honest, I think more than half of emissions is actually personal vehicles. But freight is indeed an enormous amount of emissions. And in that space, I'm mostly interested in the 40-ton trucks. So the really big rigs, as you call them, the 18-wheelers, exactly. Because that is where two-thirds actually of road freight emissions come from. And people are always sort of shying away from that. They want to talk about all those other vehicles because they think those are easier for electric vehicles. They think if it's smaller and if it doesn't drive so far, it must be easier. Mm-hmm. But this is a misconception. This is one of those myths I try to debunk. Good. Because actually, there's two sides to the story. One is, yeah, but if you have a very big vehicle, the battery must be very heavy. Well, of course, as you and I understand, that's only as a percentage of the vehicle. So a larger vehicle needing a larger battery is not automatically a problem. It's just, if you make the vehicle twice as large and the battery twice as large, it's basically the same as two vehicles that are smaller with smaller batteries. So uh-huh. This is somehow a mental misconception. But when we started looking in this into semi trucks more specifically, with a colleague of mine who is doing his PhD on this, we found out that if you do the same as Tesla is doing with the Tesla Semi, and as we at the automotive department were saying for a long while now, you would put the motors very close to the wheels, basically as we do in electric vehicles. You would also do it in the truck. So basically every axle that you want to drive, you give it one or two electric motors between the wheels.
Okay.
And then you actually lose a lot of stuff that transports all that all that motor power to the wheels. You don't need a differential anymore. You don't need a driving axle anymore. Everything becomes a little bit easier. So when we swapped basically the drivetrains that we know now with the drivetrains that we imagined would be optimal, which are very close to actually what Tesla is, Tesla is going to demonstrate, I hope, more publicly next year, although they're driving around now, you win about 3 tons.
Okay.
And then the battery, actually, if you use car batteries that are state-of-the-art right now, the weight would be about 6 tons. So actually, you are left with a net penalty of about 3 tons. Which, if you look, take into account, for example, that Europe already says if you're a zero emission, you can weigh 2 ton extra, no questions asked. Well, some question asked, but you can do that. Then you think, oh, this is pretty close to actually being optimal, or basically being able to carry just as much load. And if you know that most trucks actually are volume constrained, basically they stop loading the truck when it's full. Instead of weight constraint, they stop loading the truck when it becomes too heavy. Mm-hmm. Then you know that already basically over half of electric trucks could be replaced with no problem whatsoever if you could buy them. But somehow people find this business case I don't know, where they shy away with it. Now, the interesting part is once you've tackled this weight problem, And as I said, I forget one thing. If you look at how batteries are developing, mm-hmm. and if you also look about new tricks like structural batteries, where you also use the battery that you take anyway to make your truck stiffer and throw out some other steel beams, yep. then you would actually already be there. So we could already make trucks theoretically that could take just as much weight. And the batteries are only getting lighter and lighter and lighter. So this more heavy story is history in 5 years. Now, the business case-wise, actually, trucks are great. Actually, trucks are the best way to earn back your batteries because you drive lots of kilometers every day.
Yep.
So instead of a car where you drive one-tenth of the range you want to have because it makes you feel good, and because sometimes you have to drive long distance. So in a car, you on average day use about one-tenth of the battery that you have in your car, which makes the payback time a little bit longer. Then with a truck, where you basically use, let's say, two-thirds of this energy every day, because those trucks, those rigs, they are flogged. Those people driving them have to drive them for 8 hours, and they want maximum efficiency. So they always drive more than 500 kilometers a day, sometimes up to 800 kilometers a day. So your payback time is phenomenal. So my prediction is that this is a category that will go from, we don't want to talk about it because it's probably very hard, to, whoa, this is the most clear business case, and we'll see the strongest adoption of any type of vehicle. And then we also come to your fleet, mm-hmm. because indeed what many people forget is that not every electric truck has to compete with the theoretical case of, I want to drive 2,000 kilometers to the south of Spain and then 2,000 kilometers to Italy and then back again. Actually, there's only a very small percentage of trucks that drive like that. We did a lot of research in the Rotterdam, with the Port of Rotterdam. Okay. And turns out about 80% of trucks, probably even a little bit more, they basically come home to the same place that they started every day. So overnight charging would be fine for them.
Okay.
And they drive between 500 and 700 kilometers a day. And that's it. So for those 80%, let's start with those, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other 20%, let's keep it up for debate. Instead of what they're doing now, throwing the most difficult business case at your feet and saying, look, you can do that, so electric vehicles will never be a thing. Because you have fleets, you can choose. You don't need a one-trick pony. You don't need one vehicle that can do it all. You can choose some vehicles to use some vehicles on the difficult routes for electric, and let's say 80% for the electric vehicle routes. So fleets are another joker, I would say, that the people selling electric trucks can play, and that will make it very clear that they are a really good alternative already, once you can buy them, with current technology at least.
Superb.
Does that make sense?
It does indeed. It does, absolutely.
Okay.
It does. Okay, we're coming towards the end of the podcast now. Is there anything we've not touched on that you think it's important for people to be aware of? Any question I've not asked you that you think I should have?
Yeah, maybe. Are you hopeful?
That was my next question.
Oh, actually, then we think very much alike. Because what I think is that too many people are still, I would say, stuck in thinking about all this renewable stuff and this electric stuff as something that's worse than what we had, but we have to do it anyway. And I think that's really the wrong way to look at it. I often say maybe the Industrial Revolution, maybe fossil fuels was our caterpillar stage, and now we're coming to the butterfly stage, because it was always clear that fossil fuels would be temporary. It was always clear that we were using them up 100,000 times or even more as fast as they were being created. Uh-huh. It was always clear that they were not really good for the environment. They were filthy, et cetera, et cetera. Now we're going towards forms of energy that are essentially abundant, essentially endless. I mean, a couple of billions of years, yes, I know. And if we need 1,000 times more energy, we have to go into space, I know. But practically speaking, endless and abundant could be very cheap. So I think we're entering a better stage, actually, for humanity. The only thing is that we have a lot of problems that we created in the past 25, that we started creating in the past 250 years, that are now sort of driving things. Now things are sort of coming to a head. So climate change is real. Climate change is a real problem. We have to be fast about it. But if you think about it, if we do this very quickly, we'll just create this better world more quickly. I mean, what's the problem? And if we gave it the same sort of intensity we usually reserve for our basest emotions, for shooting at our neighbor or something, if we would take 1/10 of the energy we expended and money we expended, for example, on a world war, this thing would be over in 10 years. So what are we waiting for?
Nice. Lovely. Okay, if people want to know more about yourself or about any of the things we've talked about today, where would you have me direct them?
Yeah, I would say your best shot would probably be at Twitter, where my name is Auke Hoekstra. It's also my Twitter
handle. I'll have a link in the show notes, yeah.
And the exciting stuff for me on renewable energy, it's all going to be, it's only partly there yet, on Neon Research. and on the website of my my small company, Zenmo.
Perfect.
But if you just Google my name, I'm not that hard to find.
Okay, super. Okay, that's been great. Thanks a million for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Okay, we've come to the end of the show. Thanks everyone for listening. If you'd like to know more about Climate 21, feel free to drop me an email to tom.raftery@sap.com or connect with me on LinkedIn or Twitter. If you liked the show, please don't forget to subscribe to it in your podcast application of choice to get new episodes as soon as they're published. Also, please don't forget to rate and review the podcast. It really does help new people to find the show. Thanks. Catch you all next time.